one person kind of from each side to present their views and then take questions from the committee. Well, for various reasons, that happens. People cancel at the last minute or things happen. You know, when we did the Article 5, my star person was coming from Tennessee and due to weather-related issues couldn't make it. But fortunately, we did find somebody from the 11th hour to come in. But anyway, so today we do only have one person. So, you know, I might be sitting up here playing devil's advocate. I tend to like to do that anyway. And so we're all going to kind of hear from one, a presenter or witness, if you will, and then just simply take questions from the committee. So with that, I want to introduce Mike Mahari from the 10th Amendment Center. Mike, so stand with the microphone, kind of introduce yourself, tell us what you want us to know about you, kind of who you are, where you're from, what you're doing here, what are your credentials, and whatever else you want to know. Go ahead.
All righty. Well, good morning, and thank you so much for having me. My name is Mike Mahari. I'm the National Communications Director for the 10th Amendment Center, which is a national organization. We're primarily focused on political decentralization through federalism, utilizing the 10th Amendment. We do constitutional education, and then we also do a lot of political activism at the state and local level, primarily designed to blunt what we believe is overreaching federal power, federal authority. I'm from right down the road in Lexington, Kentucky, so I got up bright and early and apparently missed the traffic, which was good. So, I've been with the 10th Amendment Center for almost 10 years now. I've been studying the Constitution, particularly focusing on the ratification debates, because I believe that's where you really find what the true intent and meaning of the Constitution is. That's what was agreed to. That was the understanding at the time. So that's what I primarily focused my studies on. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about the 10th Amendment Center. I'm going to really focus specifically on what you can do as a state legislature within the current system and environment that we have. So the 10th Amendment, in a nutshell, the Mike Mahari Cliff Notes version, any power that was not delegated to the federal government remains with the state governments and the people. Very simple. Interestingly, Thomas Jefferson called the 10th Amendment the foundation of the Constitution. Kind of interesting to look at the way things are today because most people don't talk about the 10th Amendment ever. In fact, I've got some friends that took the bar exam and they told me that when they were doing exam prep, they were actually told that if there was a multiple choice question and one of the answers was 10th Amendment, you could just strike that off because 10th Amendment was never the right answer. So I think if Jefferson was correct and it is the foundation of the Constitution, we might have strayed a little bit from what the system was intended to be. So I'm just going to give a real quick brief overview, a little historical background, and then kind of move into some practical application. What is the 10th Amendment? Basically, it's what is known as a rule of construction. So in other words, it really doesn't do anything. Theoretically, if you took the 10th Amendment out, the Constitution would still read the exact same way. So it doesn't add any power. It doesn't take away any power. It really just tells you how to read the Constitution. And there's plenty of evidence to support this idea that the Constitution, we should read it as if the 10th Amendment existed, even if it didn't, because virtually all of the major supporters of the Constitution during the ratification period made this argument. I think one of the most important was James Wilson in what is known as the State House speech. It was one of the very first public speeches about the Constitution. It kind of set the tone. He laid out the reasons that America should support this, that the state should ratify this document. And he made an interesting distinction. He talked about the state governments, and he said legislative power in state governments, it was assumed that if it wasn't forbidden, it wasn't prohibited, then the state government could do it. They could legislate on that issue. But he said that the federal constitution was different. He said that he said it was the reverse. He said, the proposition prevails and everything which is not given is reserved. So with the states, everything that is not reserved is given. And with the federal government, everything that is not given is reserved. And that was the foundation. And people argued this all the way through the ratification debates. So we have these delegated powers. You look at Congress, Article 1, Section 8. That lists specific things that the Congress was empowered to do. That delegation of powers implies a limitation. I mean, why would you make a list if it was anything and everything, right? I mean, you wouldn't do that. You would just say you have legislative authority. They didn't do that. They made a specific list. And in Federalist 83, Alexander Hamilton, and I love to quote Hamilton because Hamilton was probably the most nationalist of our founding fathers. In fact, I tend to think that he was kind of fudging a little bit when he said things in the ratification debates because he wanted to get the thing in place so that he could kind of do his own thing. But if you look at what he says during the ratification process, he also argued for a very narrowly construed federal government. He said the separation of particulars, and he was speaking of the 18 enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8, he said it evidently excludes all pretensions to a general legislative authority because an affirmative grant of special powers would be absurd as well as useless if a general authority was intended. So that's basically what I was just saying. You don't make a list if it's anything and everything. So I think it's not even debatable that the federal government was intended to have limited powers and that most of the authority was to remain in the state governments. Now, we can certainly debate what the extent of that federal authority is, but I don't think there's any debate that there is limits on federal authority, theoretically. James Madison really made this explicit during the ratification debates, and I think his Federalist 45 gives us the best real quick overview of what the relationship between the state and the federal government is supposed to look like. Madison said, the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which remain to the state governments are numerous and indefinite. So you got few and defined, numerous and indefinite. Now, if we look at the system that we're operating in today, I think it is flipped on its head. We have a federal government that basically claims the authority to do anything. They're the ones exercising the undefined and unlimited powers. The federal government claims the authority to tell you how much water you can have in your toilet and what kind of light bulbs you can screw in your light fixture. So I don't think that fits into the whole general theme of few and defined. Maybe that's just me, but that's kind of the way I see it. So this system doesn't remotely resemble the system we have today. I think we can probably agree on that. Again, we can argue where those lines are supposed to be, but I think we can all agree that there's supposed to be lines and that, by and large, the federal government has crossed those in many, many ways. And I think it's interesting because whatever side of the political spectrum you're on, I think you can look at areas where you're going to say, oh, the federal government should not be doing that. Now, we tend to like the things the federal government does that we like, because we like them. But I would argue that we should stick to these defined powers all of the time, because as soon as you allow the power to be in place, you got to know the next guy is going to be in charge. I think a lot of progressives have learned the hard way that a lot of the overreach that happened during the Obama administration, Trump is running right along with it. So I think it's important to stick to that framework. I mean, after all, the Constitution is supposed to be the law of the land, right? But here's the $64,000 question. We can agree that the federal government was supposed to be limited. The question becomes, how do you keep it that way? And I think that's been the great failure of the American constitutional experiment. Now, I will propose to you that during the ratification debates, the assumption was that the states would serve as a check on federal authority. There was a delegate, Fisher Ames, who was from Massachusetts, and he pushed for language to be included in the Constitution, to be amended, that will eventually become the 10th Amendment. And this is what he wrote, or actually he said, so this is a transcription of what they say he said during the ratification debates. A consolidation of the states would subvert the new Constitution, and against which this article, being the 10th Amendment language, is our best security. Too much provision cannot be made against consolidation. So consolidation is the idea that all of the states, you just erase the state borders and you have one central government. The state governments represent the wishes and feelings and the local interests of the people. They are the safeguard and the ornament of the Constitution. They will protect the period of our liberties. They will afford a shelter against the abuse of power and will be the natural avengers of our violated rights. They write a lot better than I do. So that's you guys. So here's the $64,000 question again. How do you do this? Okay, what can the states actually do? Well, there was this idea that was really formalized in 1798. It was actually implicit in many of the ratification debates. And it's this idea of nullification. Now, nullification gets a really bad rap for some fair reasons. And I'm not going to get a whole deep into the history of it at this point. I'll take questions if we want to afterwards. But in a nutshell, nullification is the idea that the states have the authority to essentially block unconstitutional federal acts. This was not something that Mike Meharry came up with. This was actually first formally articulated by James Madison and Thomas Jefferson in the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions of 1798. These documents were passed by the Kentucky legislature and the Virginia legislature. They were in response to the Alien and Sedition Acts. Jefferson said that nullification is, quote, the rightful remedy. And James Madison said this. He said, in case of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercise of other powers not granted by the said compact, meaning the Constitution, the states who are parties thereto have the right and are in duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of the evil and for maintaining within their respective limits the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them. So, in essence, Madison was saying that it is the responsibility of the state governments to step up when the federal government grievously overreaches. It overreaches big, is what I'm trying to say. That's the responsibility of the state governments. The interesting thing about this is people talk about this idea that was formalized in these resolutions, but interestingly, they didn't really nullify anything. They basically just said, we have the power to do this. They never really said what that process is, how it would work. And you can see that in the correspondence back and forth between Madison and Jefferson after the resolutions were passed. It's interesting because Jefferson told Madison, he sent him a copy of his resolutions that actually said nullification. And he said, I think we should distinctly affirm all of the important principles they contain so as to hold to that ground in the future and leave the matter in such a train as that we may not be committed absolutely to push the matter to extremes and yet may be free to push as far as events will render prudent. So they were establishing a philosophical framework, but they never really established how they were going to do this. And so we still have the $64,000 question hanging up there. How in the world can a state push back against overreaching federal power? Well, I'm about to tell you. And James Madison actually told us. He gave us a blueprint in Federalist 46. Now, it's interesting to me that Federalist 46 is right after 45. 45 established that the federal government was supposed to be limited. So the next question was, how do you keep it that way? And Madison wrote in Federalist 45, he said that, or Federalist 46, he said that the means of opposition are powerful and at hand. Opposition to what? Unwarrantable federal acts was the word that he used. And then he went on and he said, even warrantable federal acts that happen to be unpopular. He said that states could do a number of things, and he listed some things like protests, like the government, a governor can send a protest, or the legislature could pass a resolution and send it to Congress. But I think the most important thing that he said that states could engage in a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union. Those are the exact words that he used, a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union. Now, that sounds radical and it sounds crazy, but if you ask me, I think it's radical and crazy to let the federal government do anything it wants to. So we have this idea that the federal government shouldn't do things and that the state governments can refuse to cooperate with doing them. So how does this work? Well, I'll give you an analogy that I like to use. I drove up here today from Lexington. The speed limit was 70. Not to incriminate myself, but I didn't drive 70. Most people didn't drive 70. So there's this idea, we talk about nullification. There's really two definitions of the term. One is a legal nullification. If a judge says that this law is void, it is struck off the books, it's gone forever, that is legal nullification. And in fact, when you talk about nullification, that's what most people that went to law school will think. They're thinking legal nullification. But there's also a common definition, which is basically just to make void or null or ineffective. So what I did today was I nullified the speed limit. We all nullify the speed limit. The police cannot enforce the speed limit. Now, they can pull you over, and they may get one or two people here and there, but the bottom line is they cannot force all of the traffic to go at that speed limit. Anybody who's ever driven in Houston, Texas, knows this is a fact. It's scary, let me tell you. So we have this ability to refuse to cooperate. So what does that look like? What am I actually talking about here in practical terms? Well, I think the best example that we've seen started in 1996 when the state of California passed a proposition and legalized medical marijuana. Now, the federal government still to this day maintains that marijuana is a controlled substance. It's absolutely illegal in all situations. But the fact of the matter is, since California took that step in 1996, despite the fact that the FDA or the DEA tried to crack down, despite the fact that the Supreme Court ruled that the federal government can indeed regulate six plants in a woman's backyard, despite the fact that there have been more and more aggressive attempts to stop marijuana. Interestingly, the Obama administration in its first term, first 4 years of Obama administration, actually spent more on marijuana enforcement than Clinton and Bush combined. So there's this myth that Obama just kind of backed off and let it go. That's not true. Today, we have 33 states, I believe including Ohio, that have medical marijuana. We have 10 states now that have just legalized it completely. I emphasize the fact that the federal government still claims that it's completely illegal. This is what happens when states refuse to cooperate with officers of the union. When the state says, you know what, we're going to do our own thing, we're going to go our own way, the federal government can try to enforce it if they want to, but we're going to do this, the federal government is pretty much helpless, because the dirty little secret is the federal government depends on state and local support for virtually everything that it does. If you've ever watched a drug raid on TV, you'll see one DEA agent and about 65 police and sheriff deputies. Now imagine for a second the police and sheriff deputies don't show up. The feds have a little bit of a problem. So you can take this strategy that has been used for legalizing marijuana and you can apply it to virtually anything that the federal government does. Another good example is hemp. Kind of in the same category, Colorado is one of the first states to legalize hemp for commercial sale. And again, at that time, there was complete federal prohibition on that, and there was some crackdown, but there was enough of an appetite for a market that the federal people were willing to risk that federal enforcement, knowing that the state wasn't going to bother them, and in fact, the state was supporting what they were doing. Now, as you all probably know, just last year, President Trump signed a farm bill into law that completely legalizes hemp at the federal level. But at that point, there was like 33 states that were already commercially farming hemp. And despite the 2014 farm bill, which purported to legalize hemp for research purposes only, all of these research programs, including in my home state of Kentucky, were blatantly flouting federal law and allowing commercial sale of hemp. I mean, I take CBD oil, I have arthritis, and I walk into a store and I buy it. According to the federal government, that was illegal up until about 4 or 5 weeks ago. So, a refusal to cooperate with officers of the union. In other words, states don't have to participate in enforcement of federal laws and in implementation of federal programs. Now, I would argue that a state could theoretically block enforcement of an unconstitutional federal law. And there'll be a lot of people that would debate me on that, and it would be a heated debate, and you know, we would probably be at loggerheads and never come to an agreement. But there is no question that the federal government can't make the state help them, because this is something that is locked into constitutional law. And that's the beauty of what I'm talking about here. It may sound radical, it may sound crazy, but the Supreme Court gives it a 110% thumbs up. There's a legal doctrine known as the anti-commandeering doctrine. In effect, the anti-commandeering doctrine holds that the federal government cannot force a state to implement a federal program or enforce a federal law. It cannot force a state to utilize its resources nor its personnel. This has been developed on a legal foundation that actually started in 1842, and it's built on four more Supreme Court cases, the most recently being just last year, Murphy versus NCAA, which was the gambling case. Like I said, in a nutshell, I'm going to repeat this again because I think it's important to wrap our heads around this. The federal government cannot force a state to use its personnel or resources to pursue a federal purpose. It's as simple as that. So, if you guys don't want to enforce federal marijuana laws, you don't have to enforce federal marijuana laws. If you don't want to enforce federal gun laws, you don't have to enforce federal gun laws. And as we're finding out, if there's a state that doesn't want to enforce federal immigration laws, they don't have to enforce federal immigration laws. You will notice that despite the fact of all the bluster that's come out of Washington, D.C., these sanctuary cities are still getting their funding. There's nobody making arrests because they can't do it legally. So I'm going to read a couple of these cases because I think they're key. The first one, like I said, 1842, it was Prigg versus Pennsylvania. It was Joseph Story, who interestingly was a very strong nationalist and probably one of the people responsible for bringing us to the point that we are today. But, you know, I'm a pragmatic squirrel. I'll take a good nut wherever I can find it. This was actually a fugitive slave case. And I won't get into the whole details of the case, but the important part for our discussion is that Joseph Story held that the state of Pennsylvania could not block enforcement of fugitive slave rendition. So he couldn't block federal marshals. He couldn't block a person from coming in and trying to receive their property. I use property in air quotes. If I ever say that, please understand that. But he said that the state could not be forced to help with fugitive slave rendition. He said the fugitive slave clause is found in the national constitution and not in that of any state. It does not point out that any state functionaries or any state action to carry the provisions into effect. The states cannot, therefore, be compelled to enforce them. And it might well be deemed an unconstitutional exercise of the power of interpretation to insist that the states are bound to provide means to carry into effect the duties of the national government nowhere delegated or entrusted to them by the Constitution. So that was the foundation of this anti-commandeering doctrine. And it's really interesting how this played out because I think Joseph Story thought that he was going to increase federal power and make fugitive slave rendition more easy. And what happened was, is the states looked at this and they said, hey, wait a minute, we don't have to help? Cool, we're not going to help. And when the most draconian Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was passed, a lot of states actively refused to provide personnel and resources. For instance, the state of Michigan prohibited fugitive slave catchers from using any state or city jail. In Massachusetts, anybody that worked in state government that worked as a slave commissioner was forever barred from holding state office again. So these states took this and they said, you know what, we're not going to enforce this horrible fugitive slave clause. Interesting aside, a lot of times when you talk about nullification, there's this stigma to it. If you've ever watched like Rachel Maddow, okay, talk about nullification, you're going to get a picture of John C. Calhoun about the point that he had tuberculosis and looked crazy. And they're going to tell you that it's all about slavery and that anybody who pushes this position is a racist. But the truth of the matter is that it was northern states that used these very principles, this anti-commandeering doctrine and more. In fact, in Ohio, they actually arrested some federal marshals when they tried to capture a runaway slave, which I think is a cool story. But so the truth of the matter is this was actually used by northern states to aggressively stop fugitive slave rendition. And if you read some of the secession documents, particularly South Carolina, I believe Texas and Mississippi, they both mention nullification as being a problem. So any rate, so that was the first case and Bunny trailed there and didn't really intend to, but I like that story. So I think the key case here is Prince versus U.S. This was a 1996 case, I believe. It was related to the Brady Gun Bill. In the Brady Gun Bill, there were provisions that required sheriff's offices in counties to help with the federal gun registry. And a couple of sheriffs, Sheriff Prince and Sheriff Mack in Arizona, they actually sued the federal government and said, you can't commandeer our sheriff's department to run your gun registry. If you want to run a gun registry, run it yourself. And the Supreme Court, building on this anti-commandeering doctrine, held that that was in fact the case. One of the very few Supreme Court cases that really affirms this idea of the 10th Amendment. I'm going to read a little part of this too. They said, we held in New York, this was a previous case on the anti-commandeering doctrine, that Congress cannot compel states to enact or enforce a federal regulatory program. Mark that down. The federal government cannot compel the states to enact or enforce a federal regulatory program. I don't care what federal regulatory program is, whether it's EPA, DEA, FDA, ABC, or XYZ. You guys don't have to utilize your departments to enforce that. You're welcome to, but you don't have to. The the ruling went on and said, today we hold that Congress cannot circumvent that prohibition by conscripting the state's officers directly. So in other words, federal government can't come in and say, we're going to use your sheriff's office to enforce this law. State officers directly. It says, the federal government may neither issue directives requiring the states to address particular problems, nor command the state's officers or those of their political subdivisions to administer or enforce a federal regulatory program. It matters not whether policymaking is involved, and no case-by-case weighing of the burdens or benefits is necessary. Such commands are fundamentally incompatible with our constitutional system of dual sovereignty. So there you go. Anti-commandeering doctrine. I think that is the key for you guys as a state legislature, for you guys as a federalism committee. We can have the theoretical debate about federal supremacy, about where are those lines in the sand that the federal government should or should not cross. We can definitely have those discussions. Those are important discussions. But there is no question that you have the right and the power and the authority to refuse to allow Ohio resources to be used for the enforcement of federal laws or the enforcement of federal programs. Now, it's up to you guys to decide what policies are going to benefit the state of Ohio. And, of course, you're welcome to assist with the federal government however far you want. I would argue that anything that's unconstitutional, you should absolutely stay away from, even if it's a policy that you favor. Because, like I said, when you start growing power, you never can put that genie back in the bottle again. But you guys have that power and you guys have that authority. So utilize that anti-commandeering doctrine to advance the cause of the state of Ohio. So that's basically my very quickly spoken. I don't know if I'm under 20 minutes or not, but I'm more than happy to take any questions, comments. Sure.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mahar. Yeah, it was about 25 minutes. You're good. Any questions from the committee? Representative Kaler, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Becker. And say your last name for me.
Meharry. It's like Meharry Head, okay. Which is ironic.
I have that same issue. I appreciate your words in talking about anti-commandeering and the fact that the federal government cannot force the states, but I guess I look at the federal purse, mm-hmm. and the fact that there's an addictive drug that we cannot run away from. And as our federal government runs up a budget deficit, or are basically we're $22 trillion in debt. At the state level, I think most of the reps here would agree that state testing in our state is something we have struggles with. And the fact that it is not something we want to participate in, but the only way to get the federal dollars is to participate in the testing. Where does that fit into this argument of the 10th Amendment and the fact that the federal government can't force us, but they can entice us? I guess, where does that all fit in?
Yeah, that's the big fly in the ointment, and you've hit on it. And I don't necessarily have a direct answer to that question. Now, I will say it's important to understand when it comes to federal funding that there are limits that the federal government can go to in terms of using that as a stick, okay? And by that, I mean, one of the anti-commandeering cases was actually Sebelius, which was the Obamacare case. And obviously they ruled that Obamacare was constitutional, but also in that ruling they talked about the Medicaid mandates. And originally in the original Obamacare bill, they were going to take away Medicaid funding if the state didn't do the Medicaid expansion. I might be saying it wrong. Medicaid and Medicare, I get this too mixed up. But the federal medical program, let's put it that way.
Medicaid expansion.
Okay, so Medicaid expansion. So I was right. So the court in Sebelius ruled that they could not use those funds as a hammer. In other words, they couldn't force you guys to do something to expand Medicaid by threatening to take those funds away if it is coercive. Now, there's some wiggle room in there about what is coercive. And there have been some cases, for instance, in the 1980s when they did the 21 drinking age, the court actually ruled that the amount of money, highway money, that they were talking about withholding if they didn't raise the DUI level was not to that level of being a coercive. But there is that level there. They found it in Sebelius. And it's also important to note that when it comes to federal funding, if you guys decide you're not going to enforce an education mandate, the federal government can certainly withhold money that's attached to education. And that kind of makes sense. I mean, you're not doing something that they're paying you to do. That's fair enough. But they can't take away your highway funds. So, you know, that's the big problem that the Trump administration has run into with these sanctuary cities. They want to withdraw funding. They can't do it. They can only withdraw funding that has to do with immigration enforcement. So that's not really a whole lot of funding. So, you know, to answer your question more specifically, I don't have the answer, and that's what you guys as budget people have to try to figure out. Can we live, you know, how can we work our budget and work in a way that we can live without this funding, you know, and find those trade-offs? It's interesting. A couple of years ago, I think it was HUD, Housing and Urban Development, ratcheted up some of the requirements for HUD money that was coming into various counties and cities. And all of a sudden, we saw this huge rash of these counties and city governments saying, okay, we're done. I mean, it got to the point that the requirements were too draconian to justify the funding. So, you know, again, I wish I had a better answer than that, because we all struggle with budgets. Obviously, the federal government's not so good at it. Unfortunately for you guys, you don't have a printing press. You know, that would solve your problem, I guess, according to some people. But, yeah, so just understand that there are limits to what the federal government can do with you in terms of funding. But, you know, obviously that is, you know, that is a problem, I know, for all state governments.
Representative Miller has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Harry, for coming in. This is an excellent topic. I enjoy all the Constitution modeling. There's a bunch of people whose latitude. I want to get to a question here at the end, but Representative Kohler had asked you about this idea of commandeering states and their education departments to mandate certain things like testing and so forth. You've come up with this idea of nullification, whether it be legal nullification or personal nullification, and I think that's awesome, maybe you'll hear me. And where does that idea of this country of ours, a partly national, partly federal country, where does that nullification come to an end? If liberty starts and freedom starts from the individual, which James Wilson was an anti-federalist, but understood the need to protect this budding nation from many outside issues of the day, whether it be economic or maybe a return to Britain. This idea of nullification, so we'll take Representative Kohler's argument here. If we really get to the nub of this, this is about freedom, about individuals being able to have a say in their republic through a democratic process. We pick our congressmen and women. We pick our state reps. We elect them both. We pick our local officials. Where does that stop? Because at a local level, how about a school district saying, you know what, right now we have a school district that's been commandeered. It's been commandeered by the state government. It's been commandeered by the ODE. It now owns it in my district. It has commandeered its resources. It has taken it over. And does that district have the ability, under this idea of nullification, under this idea of when extreme encroachments happen at the federal level or at the state level, now to the local level, do they have the right to say, you know what? We don't believe this is the case. We nullify the state of Ohio's ability to come in and mess with our board-elected school district. We establish.
Simple answer?
Sure.
No. Because there's a fundamental difference between the relationship between a state and a county or a state and local government. That's a completely different relationship than the relationship between a state and the federal government. So in Ohio, let's say, what county are we in? I don't even know.
Franklin
County. Okay. So Franklin County, Ohio. It is a political subdivision of the state of Ohio. In essence, Ohio has complete control. The county has no sovereignty whatsoever in that system. The state of Ohio created the county. It creates the cities. The state of Ohio is the sovereign entity. When you go up the ladder to the federal government, the state of Ohio is still the sovereign entity. The states came together. They were sovereign, independent states. This is, you can look at it. They were independent colonies. They seceded from Britain as independent colonies. They were recognized by Britain in the Treaty of Paris as independent states, each one having the ability to do everything that a state could do. And when they said state, they mean nation. And they decided that they wanted to come together and form a union. And when they formed that union, they delegated certain powers to the federal government to operate in their behalf. That's not the relationship of the state. The state created the federal government. The state created the counties and the cities. The federal government did not create the states. The states created the federal government. So it's really a matter of who is the creator and who is the created one. So in essence, you guys, the state, now, I will, you know, there's different states are different, because actually in the state of Illinois, they have this idea of home rule. And states actually, or counties actually do have some autonomy in the state of Illinois. But I don't know what the particular system. I know in Kentucky that the states, the counties and the cities are at the complete mercy of the state government. So it's a different relationship. And, you know, that's the basic answer.
Can I follow up on that?
Yeah.
So, Ryan, I would agree that the chartered or states that were municipalities, counties, whatever, under the state of Ohio, home rule being a big one here in Ohio, we believe strongly in home rule. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I believe this type of discussion in this forum really helps bring out. The issue that I would ask, or I guess the question I would ask is, so if that's the case, do you believe that our nation, the United Nation, is just this compact of states that have come together, and if you believe they can nullify, can they secede? I mean, can they just say, hey, if I agree to the it's no longer a good relationship, it's time to step out. I mean, this nullification opens up Pandora's box to states going rogue, states going against other states. There's some issues that I see being the problem. I tried to give an example at a local level against the state. So we'll go back, because, you know, I guess that wasn't a good apples-to-apples comparison. Do we really want to open up this idea of nullification?
Yeah, absolutely, we do. Because we have created a system that is exactly what all of the anti-federalists, those that were opposed to the Constitution, warned was going to happen, and what the people that supported the Constitution and ostensibly what the Constitution was ratified on. We've created a system that is exactly what they warned about and what they promised wasn't going to happen. We have a consolidation of states. We have basically, we're moving rapidly toward being a unitary nation. Now, in my point of view, just getting a little bit philosophical, I believe that when it comes to liberty, the biggest threat is centralized authority. I don't trust any government. All due respect to you guys, I don't really trust you either. I'm sure you're great people, and I know that the people that are in this room have the best interest of the state of Ohio at heart. You do. But I also know that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And when you start consolidating authority at the top level, I think that's more dangerous than the risk that we have of butting heads on various and individual things. I look at it like Monopoly, okay? My wife used to work for Kroger, so it would have been a really good benefit for us if Kroger had a monopoly on groceries. Would have been a big thumbs up because, you know, my wife was a manager, so hey. But obviously for you guys, the shoppers, you don't want Kroger to be the only option that you have to go get groceries, right? Because we all know what would happen. You would get bad service, you would get higher prices, all of the things that go along with only having one entity competing. Or, you know, if you don't like Kroger, let's say Walmart or whatever. Most people intuitively understand that. Most people will tell you, no, I don't want a monopoly in groceries or a monopoly in the business world. Then why in the world are we so ready to embrace monopoly in government? Because you get the same problems. You know, you've got bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. telling people in Missouri or people in Alaska. Hey, I'll give you an example. Wyoming. Just recently, the grizzly bear was on the endangered species list, okay? They took the grizzly bear off the endangered species list. This was actually the Department of Wildlife. They took it off. A bunch of environmentalists got mad, and they sued. So some federal judge, a judge, decided that the Department of Wildlife didn't know what they were talking about and put the bear back on the endangered species list. Now, Wyoming's freaking out because they've got too many bears. They were going to have a bear hunt because they need to cull the bear population because there's too many bears. But now they can't because the federal judge has decided, no, we need to protect the bear that doesn't need to be protected because this dude's not in Wyoming. So this is the problem that I see in the centralization of government. And I recognize the validity of what you're saying. But I think our political system is built on antagonism. We have parties, we have local governments, and we have state governments, and we have the federal government. And we need that rubbing up against each other. That's where the checks and balances are found. And when you start removing those checks and balances, then you get runaway power and runaway authority. I really don't think at this point, with as much that the federal government doing, that we're really in any danger of, splitting the country apart. I think we're doing a good enough job of that arguing. And I think part of the reason that we argue so much is that we've got people in one central location that are trying to dictate policies to 300 million people. And let's be honest, the political society in California is different than the political society in Ohio. There's no way, without fighting, that you're going to be able to unify those two things. So why not let Ohio be Ohio, let California be California, let Kentucky be Kentucky, and you guys do your thing, and let the federal government do the things that it's supposed to do, basically, you know, national defense, foreign affairs, foreign trade, certain few other things. Just from a theoretical standpoint, though, just kind of to go to your point, how far does this sovereignty go? I'm going to read to you something. This was from the New York ratifying document. So several of the states, about half of them, when they ratified the Constitution, they actually created documents to go with their ratification. And they laid out terms. Like Virginia had a whole bunch of amendments that they wanted to be considered. This was in the New York Ratifying Convention. They said, "We, the delegates of the people of the state of New York, do declare and make known that the powers of the government may be reassumed by the people whensoever it shall become necessary to their happiness, that every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by the said Constitution clearly delegated to the Congress of the United States or the Department of Government, therefore, remains to the people of the several states or to their respective state governments to whom they may have granted the same." So there you have the ratifying delegation in New York basically saying, we're delegating federal government these powers, and by golly, we can take them back. So that's what they thought about it.
Well, we got questions piling up here. So Colonel Miller has a question, then Representative Kaler, then back to Representative Joe Miller. Go ahead, Colonel Miller.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, Mr. Mahaffey, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So let's fast forward about 90 years.
Okay.
So
I'm dead.
From 1850 to 1860.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So, still alive.
Still alive. Wouldn't we agree that the Civil Rights Movement was an essential federal act where through unity of effort, policy, and purpose, we found a way to enfranchise and make real fundamental rights that every citizen has? So my question is, again, through the chair, if we acknowledge the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights Act, all those important things that we now, looking back and looking forward to that time, believe were really important, without that federal imprimatur, would those things really have happened in the places where there were at that time so many problems?
I think they would have. I don't think it would have happened as quickly. And I'm certainly not going to stand here and say, you know, oh no, we shouldn't have had the Civil Rights Act. I mean, my wife is black, so I'm really thankful for it because I'm glad that we could be married legally. But I don't accept the argument that without federal action, we would have never gotten to the place that we are now. I don't want to get too far into the weeds because we could have a big debate and it could get very contentious. But I think the real movement that drove the civil rights movement was the fact that people got sick of being oppressed. And you had people like Rosa Parks that finally said, you know what, I've had enough, I'm not sitting in the back of this darn bus. And I think that social movement was the driving factor, and I think the federal government, you know, followed along. You know, when you look at more things overall, I think government's a big part of the problem when it comes to race relations, to be honest with you, because I think it exacerbates the differences. And you have to remember that it was government that was able to maintain Jim Crow. You know, those were laws. I think people naturally want to get along. People naturally want to interact and hang out with each other. I mean, obviously you have people that don't, and you know, those people are of questionable moral character. But for the most part, we want to interact, we want to do business with each other. It required people passing laws in order to make segregation work. And I will grant you that I will argue to the end of the sun that some of the stuff that went on in the civil rights movement, as far as the federal government, was unconstitutional. But I will also stand here and say that, you know, the results were good. Now, how much are you, you know, at what point do you abandon principle of pragmatism? That's a decision we all have to make.
And yet, when I think about the federal regulatory scheme that protect us, particularly I'm thinking about the Environmental Protection Act, and a lot of the Environmental Protection Agency, and a lot of the federal protections for water, I think about the very encouraging comments that our governor made yesterday about the necessity to protect Ohio's rivers, Lake Erie, and, you know, where do you draw the line on state sovereignty and nullification if you say, well, the rules for Ohio and the Ohio River, slips along the Ohio River are great, but if our friends in Parkersburg, our friends in Ohio County, West Virginia see it differently, or our friends on the Monongahela, the three rivers come in, they see it differently. I know there are citizens in Representative Smith's district, Representative Taylor's district, and mine, who are victims of some nasty environmental torts, and thank goodness for the regulation and protection that federal law has afforded them. So can you square that for me, please, through the chair?
To me, it's pragmatism or principle, okay? You're talking policy, and I understand that you believe that these policies are good, and I would probably agree that some of those policies are good as well. But the bottom line is we have a system that was put in place. We have a constitution that is supposed to be the law of the land that says that the federal government's not supposed to be doing these things. Now, there are ways to let the federal government do these things without just saying, well, we'll just let them do it. It's called an amendment process. And people want to talk about, well, you know, we have to have a constitution that changes with the times. I don't disagree. They put a structure in there to do that. Why don't we use it instead of just saying, okay, federal government, we want you to do X, so we're going to let you do it. Here's the bottom line. We can argue about policies. I'm sure that there are some Republican members of the committee that could say, well, what about da-da-da that the federal government does is good. The bottom line is we have to answer the question. Are we going to be a union of states, or are we not? Because if we're going to concede that we're going to let the federal government do things because we like the environmental results or this result or that result, then you also get the federal government that locks people in cages for marijuana. You also get the federal government that sticks kids in cages at the border. So you get a federal government that runs unconstitutional wars. So to me, it's not about issues. There are a lot of things that the federal government does I don't like on either side. There are some things that I like on one side. But the fundamental question is, what kind of system are we going to have? Are we going to have the system that was created that's decentralized? Or are we going to have a monopolized system? Apparently, we're going to have a monopolized system. I mean, that seems to be the direction that we're going. I happen to think that that's a bad thing. That's why I'm here. Because like I said, I don't want Walmart running my life. So I guess that's really the best I can. I really would prefer not to get into policy, because to me it's about the principle. And I'm sure that there are things. I'll give you an example, okay? I believe that the state of California has every right to pass whatever gun regulations that it wants to pass. Now, I'm a gun guy. Concealed carry permit. Don't have to have a concealed carry permit in Kentucky in about 90 days. I'm wholeheartedly for the Second Amendment, but I also believe that in the original Constitution, the Second Amendment was not intended to bind the state governments. So I am willing to give up. If Kentucky starts passing gun laws, I'm going to protest and I'm going to be active in trying to make that not happen, but I'm not going to run to the federal government and say, please, federal government, come protect my gun rights, because if I do that, then they're also going to be protecting my right to privacy, and they've not done a very good job of that. So that's where I stand on it. To me, it's a matter of what kind of system we want. And to me, the bottom line is monopoly power is the most dangerous thing to my liberty.
Representative Kaler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Becker. I appreciate the chance to ask another question. I would like to talk about the Fisher Ames quote about consolidation of states. I do want to say, though, you should be careful running for office because you've already said you're pro-monopoly, you speed, you have take control substances.
Believe me,
Yogi the Bear.
I have no political ambitions whatsoever.
You're on record. No, I appreciate your I appreciate your.
I'm recording too. So.
I appreciate your input. And the question I have to do is with Article 5 convention.
Mm-hmm.
We've discussed that here in past committees. It was in the last GA we talked about it. From my perspective, most of the people that come in here asking for an Article 5 convention are on the far right, but most of the people that come in here asking us not to have a convention, Article 5 convention, are on the far right as well.
Yeah.
So you talk about a consolidation of states that Fisher Ames said. How does that fit in with an Article 5 convention? Is that the consolidation of states that he was afraid of? Or is it really something we were talking about, we get rid of the borders altogether?
Yeah, I think what he was driving at, and you see that, not only I pulled that quote, but there are a lot of people that talked about this idea of consolidation. Jefferson talked about it a lot. It was a fear that the states would be erased. And you especially heard it from the anti-federalists, like Patrick Henry. He was all over the whole idea of consolidation. It was the idea that those people in that time, you have to think about where they were. You know, they had just freed themselves from a very strong centralized government, a king, and a parliament parliament in England considered itself sovereign. In our system, we consider the people sovereign. That was a very radical departure in political philosophy. So the people at that time, as the Constitution was being debated, they were nervous about this idea that the government could be consolidated and then we may end up with this really strong national government and that the powers of the states because they also, you know, we tend to think of ourselves more homogenized, I think, than they did in their day. And I travel a lot. We're not nearly as homogenized as we think from the media. You know, it's very different going to... I go to Los Angeles a lot. Believe me, Los Angeles is different. Alabama is different. You know, every place is different. But it was especially true that the culture and the political values in Massachusetts and Virginia were very different. In fact, you know, it's interesting, about 20 years after the Constitution was ratified, some of the folks in the far north, the northeast, primarily the people that came from the kind of the Puritan side of the aisle, they were like, you know what, this isn't going to work. We need to split this up. We can't live with these Southerners. So they were afraid of erasing those borders. So that's what he was talking about. As far as Article 5, I'm agnostic on it. I don't know if that question was asked, but I could see some value to it. I also see that it could be problematic. My thing I usually tell people when they talk about new amendments is we've got a bunch of them and they don't follow the ones we've got, so we better figure out some mechanism to at least try to hold them to what they're supposed to be doing in the first place.
Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Harry. My question will be on factions.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm going to get to.
So we're going Madison.
There is an end for Madison's factions, yes. So one of the things you stated about New York, and New York being a very anti-federalist state, one of the last ones to enter into to the compact, as I wink and nod and joke, or into this union, as some would argue that our United States became after a confederation of states. So New York enters, there's a big debate, 10th Amendment arrives among one of the 10. I don't know if the order is... for a reason or not, that it was the last, but...
It was actually 12.
You know, well, the two were not dropped off, but it actually got ratified, it actually made
right.
It. And speaking to that, yes, even Pennsylvania wanted a Bill of Rights in the Constitution for fishing rights, so there were some extremes out
sure.
there, right, I get that. So Hamilton, Madison talks about factions, and we see that. We see that today because a lot of times local governments, and even some state governments, you seem to see a family heritage, you know, where families continue to have control over local governments.
You mean like the Bushes?
Or state governments, yes, and I think that's how you remember those days. And so the factions was a big concern of Madison. I don't remember which Federalist paper that Madison wrote on that, but I know his experience with the House of Burgesses down in Virginia caused him to be very concerned about that. I like what you said about the antagonism. That's a big piece. And that antagonism has to be there, and I agree. But Hamilton, and I hope I'm right on this, I think it's 19, Hamilton says in Federalist 19, Hamilton had stated, listen, the reason we need this union and the reason we need to have a supreme government is because of what took place in Germany. I mean, you have 30 years war, you had factions, a lot of times on bloodlines and what have you, fighting and warring over religion. You have the Protestant, German Lutherans, German Catholics. I mean, you have a lot of these problems, and so this united Germany was going to solve that. I'm concerned about going back to this idea of nullification and allowing states more power, because then states are going to combat each other. Because I promise you, if we start dumping lead and garbage into our river and it goes downstream, the states below us are going to be pretty upset. And if other states are dumping things in the lake, like Michigan, that could be a problem as well. So going back to factions, and I'll end with this, do you not think that the system that we've been built and this idea of factions is why we need a federal government? And why we need that federal government, which was actually horizontally spread out so that it could be checking itself and antagonistic to itself, right? So if we wanted antagonism vertically, we, under the Montesquieu idea, we've separated it with the Supreme Court, the Congress, and the executive branch. Now, my argument would be, the problem with the federal government is not that states aren't doing their job. It's the Congress is not doing its job, and it's yielding all this power to the president. And the courts right now are the only answer for both groups. So I don't lay that in the laps of my fellow reps and senators here in the GA, here at the state level. I lay it right on the federal Congress and the executive branch, trying to, the Congress allowing the federal branch to assert the power, and that faction. So do you think we could still call them factions? So I end with a question that I serve. Can we calm these factions? Can we prevent them from saying, you know what, we're going to separate who goes to what bathroom and what drinking fountain based on race and so forth? Can we stop that kind of behavior without a federal government that has supremacy over a state government? Can we still do this? Because I'm seeing you moving way towards that state, back to an Articles of Confederation mindset, a compact instead of a union that we have today. And I appreciate your allowing me to get that very long, lengthy question.
All right, let me address a couple of things. First off, as far as factions, Madison did argue, his argument essentially was that with smaller units, like you said, the government of Virginia, that you're going to end up with these factions and factions with control. And he argued that with a larger government, that it would basically dilute the factions. I think if you look at what's happened, that didn't play out the way Madison expected. Nobody's going to sit here and tell me we don't have factions in the federal system that we have now. We certainly have factions, and the factions seem to be getting further and further apart. So I don't think that it's I don't think that that's worked. That's the nature of politics. We divide up and we fight each other. That's why I'm not a big fan. But it is what it is. That's how we've decided we're going to order society. So, no, I don't think that we're going to have more factions. I think that there'll be factions at in a smaller level. But I believe that it's easier for me as an individual to have influence at my state and local level. Like, I know my state rep. Like, I could call my state rep and he knows who I am. And I babysat my state senator's kids. So there's some connection there. And if I call them, they're probably going to take my phone call and they're probably going to listen. Now, I've also called Congress, and mostly I've talked to interns. And then I'll get an email back, and it has virtually nothing to do with what I called about. So I don't call D.C. anymore. So I feel like that as a citizen, I hate that term, but I guess that is what it is. As a citizen, I have more control over you guys than I do over Congress. And I mean that in a positive way. I mean, you guys are going to be more, listen, you're going to listen to me more because I'm closer to you than some guy in D.C. So that to factions. There was something else that I wanted to say that you said that pricked my brain, and now I can't remember what it was. I guess I don't remember what that was.
States.
Do what?
States competing against each other.
I was going to say something about that. Are you guys really going to dump lead in the water?
I hope not.
I mean, I think we tend to think that if the federal government's not there, Michigan's going to dump crap in the water. Does Michigan really want to dump crap in the water? I mean, and the federal government was involved in that as well. And here's my problem. Here's my problem with the monopolization of government. I'm not going to doubt that We don't like Michigan here, right? So I can say mean things about Michigan. Maybe Michigan is going to dump stuff in the water, right? But here's what I have a problem with. When the federal government does something, if it does something good, then it's good, right? And we're all happy. When the government, federal government does something bad, we're all stuck with it. And I've seen this especially. One of the areas, policy areas that I work most closely in as far as legislative stuff goes, surveillance. Okay. The federal government has done an absolutely horrible job of protecting the right to privacy. The NSA is basically gathering, and probably, I'm recording this, they're probably listening. And I say that half in jest. But, and you see how the federal government, through the war on drugs, has grown this surveillance state. It uses state and local police departments to operate the surveillance system. We've got this horrible, gross conglomeration of stuff. And the problem is that the federal government has set that standard and that precedent. So we could say, yeah, when it's good, it's good. But man, when it's bad, and we're all stuck with it. And so, you know, that's why I would rather see you guys fight it out with Michigan, not fight it out. I mean, I'm not suggesting an invasion or anything like that. Because then they might have people from Tennessee convene. That'd be bad. But you know, I think that we're all people that want the best, right? We don't want our lakes and rivers polluted. So, you know, I would think that you guys could work with your neighbors and maybe we could work something out without having the heavy hand of the federal government. Maybe I'm wrong, but again, balancing risk and reward, I'm going to always err on the side of decentralization. That's just my shtick.
Any other questions from any of the members of the committee? Well, I have a few. This is the lightning round.
All right. Anybody have any water?
Okay. Water.
We'll power through. Don't worry about it.
We'll see if we can find it.
Would the chair permit a 2-minute recess so you can get a drink of water?
Yeah. Go. Let's just go ahead. We don't need to recess. Let's do it. Power through, lightning round.
Yeah.
Oh, bless you. Thank you.
Well, that was easy. Thank you, Representative Catton. You are. Okay, you mentioned...
You're my favorite now.
I got several items here on bullet points, some of which you've already covered, some of which I wanted to kind of follow up on. You mentioned that the Second Amendment does not apply to the states. It only applies to the federal government. So therefore, use as an example of California. If they want to ban all guns, for example, they can do that?
Theoretically.
They have the right to do that? What about the First Amendment? Do they have the right to ban churches and printing presses and the Internet?
Well, I believe that they have a First Amendment in their state constitution, so the answer would be no.
If they change their own constitution to allow that, then the federal government can't stop them?
Theoretically.
Okay.
Of course, let's back up. Because we have the incorporation doctrine. Okay. Which Corporation Doctrine, 14th Amendment, Corporation Doctrine basically holds that the all of the Bill of Rights applies to the state governments. I personally, and we don't want to go down this wormhole today because we'll be here until tomorrow afternoon, I don't think that's a good interpretation of what the 14th Amendment was meant to do. It came about later, but that's what we have in the system. So if that was to happen, in the system that we live in, the federal government would be able to do that. But my personal opinion is if the state government is overreaching its power, we should fight at that as much as possible through the state constitutions.
Well, let's go back to the 14th Amendment. What is the original intent of the 14th Amendment? Especially elaborate on the Due Process Clause and the Equal Protection.
You really want to go down this wormhole? 14th Amendment.
Do in the next 30 seconds?
I'll do it in 30 seconds because I can't do it justice without actually having notes in front of me. If anybody's interested in the subject, I think the best academic examination of the 14th Amendment is by a guy named Raul Berger, and it's called Government by Judiciary. I think it's Berger is his last name, Raul, Raul, maybe. I probably misspelled that. It's fantastic, and it will take you like 6 months to read it because it's dense. But in essence, if you look at I look at the 14th Amendment the same way I look at the Constitution. What did they say when they were trying to get it ratified? What did it mean? In effect, it was the constitutionalization of the Civil Rights Act of 1866. So Congress passed the Civil Rights Act. It was to ensure that the newly freed slaves would have these basic set of rights, no matter where they were. They were things like access to courts, the ability to enter into contracts, to buy and sell property. Very basic fundamental things that are listed and enumerated in that Civil Rights Act. And when you go and you look at the ratification of the 14th Amendment, that's what they were all saying. This is to constitutionalize this Civil Rights Act and make sure that, because they were, that was actually happening. There were former slaves that they were passing laws that, well, you can't enter into contracts, you can't buy land, and you can't do all of these basic things that we all take for granted in civilized society. So that was the basic purpose of it. The idea of due process, it really just means that we all have access to the courts. There is a process. Everybody has the same access. You know, there's not two different court systems. The rules apply to everybody. So that's the 30-second cliff notes.
That's great. The question of secession came up earlier. Do the states have the right to secede?
I think that they do. I don't think it's a good idea.
What about judicial review? That dates back to Marbury versus Madison, 1803. Was that constitutional, or was that an overreach?
No, I think that if you read Marbury, I think people put words on him that he wasn't saying. Marbury was merely asserting that if you're going to judge a case on constitutional grounds, then you got to judge on the constitutionality of it. I mean, that's. That really wasn't all that controversial at the time. Judicial review was something that was already an established practice in colonial court systems. I think the notion that the Supreme Court is the final and sole arbiter, that if it gets it grossly wrong, we all just have to follow along and go along. I don't think that anybody ever intended that. In fact, James Madison was pretty emphatic that the Supreme Court was the final rule as far as the federal system goes, but ultimately it was the states that created the federal government, and ultimately the states could decide on the issue of constitutionality. So, but again, you know, I think, kind of bringing this full circle, those theoretical things are interesting, but we have a world that is as it was, and we have the world as Mike Meharry thinks it should be, and then we have the world as it is. And we have to operate in the world as it is. And the world as it is that most people are going to say that the Supreme Court has the final authority. They're going to go along with whatever the Supreme Court says, unless you're in Wyoming and want to hunt grizzly bears, because they just passed the law. I think they're going to do the hunt anyway. But that's another issue. But by and large, I think we have to recognize that in this, I'm not going to say that you guys should, you know, try to buck the Supreme Court, because it's not going to work. It's not going to work within the system. The system that you do have to work with, though, is that anti-commandeering doctrine. You can work within those parameters, and I think you can successfully check the federal government. So, you know, a lot of the things that we've talked about, I think, are interesting. They're philosophy. I think we need to talk about these things, because I think we need to think about the system that we live in. But as far as your guys' job, you do have some parameters that you can. If you believe that the federal government is overreaching into a certain area, you certainly have some things within the system as it exists that you can use to further the cause of Ohio.
So it sounds like the Supreme Court is not the final arbiter of the Constitution.
Well, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison said that it wasn't, but other people disagree. And I think, you know, that's something that we could go into a long discussion. I think it's a kind of an absurd idea to think that, okay, we're going to create this federal government and it's going to be limited, and we're going to delegate it certain powers, and then we're going to let it decide what its powers are. Doesn't really make sense. It'd be like me deciding, you know, if you and I were in a debate, and I said, hey, you know what, I got an idea. My mother, she's going to be the one that arbitrates between us. Now, my mom's a lovely woman, very fair, but I don't think that it would be in your best interest to let my mother arbitrate the. And that's why I think that was one of the things that I kind of flew through my mind when you were talking, that the horizontal checks. I mean, you're asking the federal government to check the federal government. And, you know, I joke sometimes, you see some of these investigations, and the federal government investigated the federal government and determined the federal government didn't do anything wrong. Yeah, that's problematic to me.
All right, so I want you to, you may have covered this earlier, maybe I just missed it, but I want to cover the Supremacy Clause and Article 6 of Section 2 and how that was originally intended to apply?
Yeah, it's really interesting because whenever you start talking about state sovereignty, that's the first thing that any law professor, if you ever read an article that talks about anything having to do with state sovereignty, you can guarantee, it's almost a joke, you can guarantee that you're going to have the law professor who's going to say, well, the supremacy clause says that the federal government, all laws of the federal government are supreme. And they always say it that way, and they always put these little ellipses, and they leave out the most important words that say, in pursuance of the Constitution. And a number of the, James, I think it's James Iredell. You seem to know. Was it James Iredell, North Carolina? I think it was James.
I'm not sure.
He was a prominent delegate in North Carolina, an advocate for the Constitution. He said that any action that was outside of the parameters of the Constitution was barefaced usurpation. That was the word that he used. So, you know, it doesn't say. The Constitution and any old law that Congress wants to pass is the supreme law of the land. It says in pursuance of the Constitution. So even Hamilton, you know, he said that it's logically follows that anything that's not in pursuance of the Constitution is quote unquote void. So then we have the question, it goes back to how do we determine what is constitutional? And, you know, that gets into the whole issue of the Supreme Court I would obviously take a much more radical stance than Representative Miller would. But, you know, like I said, we do have parameters in which we can work. And if we really do feel like the federal government's overstepped, we can at least withdraw our cooperation.
Okay. Last call. Any final questions from the committee members?
Yeah.
Representative Kent, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. And thank you, for being here to give your testimony. Are you concerned that that if we have the state sovereignty, that it will trickle down and people will want local sovereignty, like where cities decide, well, because they do say, I don't really like what the state's doing
right
either, so could this trickle down and then we have a situation where, okay, if that works, then let's locally look at how we...
Right.
Don't have to do what the states tell us. And again,
right,
I'm thinking about the testing that you talked about.
Sure.
Just once a school district in Ohio decided that they did not, you know, voted at the board, they're not going to give this testing at all.
Right.
And there was just hell to pay.
Right.
I mean, they truly, the state just really came down on them. And
yeah, and I think...
fear. So that's, I think, is a little of my concern. Are we going to have a trickle
right
down?
I think that you might have a desire for that trickle-down effect, but like I mentioned earlier, I think that the very nature of the relationship between the state and the local entities is different, and there's really no debating that the state has complete control over those local entities. I guess technically the state could probably dissolve a county if it wanted to, or dissolve a city municipality. I mean, you guys have ultimate power. They're your political subdivisions. They're not the same as the state. I mean, the state, even in today's system, as much as it's warped, the states still have a great deal of sovereignty, and cities don't. They don't have sovereignty. They're part of the big thing. So, I think I see where you're coming from as a concern. I think practically it's not terribly concerning, at least not as far as I know.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the members of the committee? Seeing that, would you like to make any final closing comments?
I think I've said enough. No, I will say thank you all. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
I think this has been very beneficial for the members. And I enjoy firing questions off in a lightning round.
Absolutely.
Sometimes I'll get that opportunity depending on the timing. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your views and expertise with us. And seeing no further business to come.